I'm here in Waterville, right out at Hog's Head, and I'm talking to Leo Quinlan. Leo, a fascinating story all about your father, who was born not too far away from here, just literally over the hill.
Oh, he was born just about 100 yards up here in that old farmhouse as you're looking out the window. You can see it here, the White House.
And he grew up with how many brothers and sisters?
He had two sisters. There was an older brother who died in infancy, but then two sisters, Mary and Kathleen, and my father was a baby.
And your mother's maiden name was?
Cunningham from Galway, Galway City.
Now, can you tell me the story relating to your father growing up? He would have grown up here farming, a little bit of fishing.
Yes. From all reports, it was a pretty tough life in those days because it's a farm of 36 acres, which, as you can see, grows equal number of rocks as it does grass. So they would have had some sheep, some cows, a horse. If I remember in my own youth when I was here, it was still like that. No electricity, fishing to supplement the food. Fishing was a necessity, not a sport. And he grew up in that kind of environment, went to school in Loher, which is just about 4 miles walking from here on the main ring of Kerry Road. The site of the old school is still there, although it's in ruins now. And he went to school there right up until he got a scholarship at St. Brendan's in Killarney.
Was there any incident in the young... Because he would have remembered the troubles here and the what went on during the War of Independence and the Civil War. Was there anything that happened in the house that would have had a lasting memory with him?
Yes. I can't give you exact dates, but from his story to me, he was about 3 or 4 years old, so it must have been during the War of Independence, when the house was being searched by the Free Staters, I think at the time. There were two men hiding in the attic of the house. They escaped through a small window and went into the mountain, chased by the Free Staters. As a result of them being in the house, my grandparents were arrested, spent 11 days in Carrigsaveen jail. The two men were hunted in the mountains for a few days. I remember my dad telling me that one of them was killed in the mountain and the other came running down the hill beside the farmhouse. My father, who was in the yard at the time, was picked up by this fugitive, thrown into the door of the farmhouse to his grandmother and was told to take care of him. And this man escaped off in the direction of Waterville. My father was very angry about this in later years because my grandmother was hit by some man called Ginger at the time, he told me, with the butt of a rifle, and she was knocked into the open fireplace that they had at the time. And my dad told me that years and years later, when he joined the army and he searched around for this Ginger, but never found him, of course, you know, 20 years had passed at that time.
So it
probably had an effect on him, all right. But, but then he joined the army later and he was a committed army guy.
Had he a choice before he joined the army?
He had, yes, of course. When he finished his schooling in St. Brendan's in Killarney, he came back, worked here as a labourer on the roads for a year while he was waiting to be called for interviews for different things. And in those days, you had to apply for the Guard, you had to apply for the Army, etc. And he applied for various things, but he was offered the Guards and the Army. He took the Army.
Did he ever tell you why he took the Army?
No, I can't say he did. I can't say he did. Maybe it was because he wanted to look for Ginger or something. I'm not sure.
So he joined the army roughly in the 1940s.
1941, I think. He did the usual cadets training in the correct camp. On commissioning as a second lieutenant, he was stationed in Galway. Lee Mellows Barracks in Galway in the 1st Battalion, and that's where, in Galway is where he met my mother, and she's a Galway woman from the Cunningham family there, and that's where most of us were born.
And could you tell me the circumstances that led up to the to going to the Congo? Because just at that time, the peacekeeping force was the Irish soldiers were sent on missions abroad to.
Yes. I think the Congo was the first one that we went to. After that, you have Kashmir and Cyprus and other places like that. So you had to be volunteers to go to the Congo, and I think the army you still have to be volunteers to go anywhere. So he volunteered. He was 42 years of age at the time. He was a combatant based in Athlone, and he was put in charge of the company from the west going to the Congo at that time, which was 1961.
Did he go out in 1960 on the first the first time?
No, they didn't go out. He wasn't in the first company
Batch.
battalion
Yeah.
to the Congo at all. No.
Okay. So it was with the 35th
35th Battalion.
Battalion that he
Yep.
went out.
Yes.
And how many men in his company?
Again, from memory, I think he had about 143. He might have had some extra people given to him when he was out there, but generally about 143.
Now, the events that unfolded over the next
6 months.
6 months, your father kept a diary, a
Yes,
record?
yes, yes. There's a lot of he was pretty good at that, and he had his own diary, an old OES book they call it, the Irish Army general book that you use for practically everything. And he kept daily notes on that, which I still have. And also he had letters almost on a daily basis to my mother, in which he told her an amazing amount of detail about his work, about the people he was with, about events as that unfolded. And they're a revelation, really. And then, of course, he had the official records of the platoon commanders, of the he as company commander, and the battalion records as well. And then he had all the signal records, that is, the messages back and forward between his company and other organizations, particularly battalion headquarters.
Now, can you tell me why they were out there at all?
In the Congo, well, United Nations were required to go to the Congo to arbitrate between the Congolese and the Katanganese. I'm putting it very simply, of course, but Katanga had broken away from the rest of the Congo, and this caused the United Nations to be requested. And the United Nations answered, and they went there. And I suppose that's it. They went out initially as peacekeepers. And remember, this was very new to the United Nations at that time, and the mandate supposedly was to keep the peace, and they were not supposed to be involved in action when you're keeping the peace, like in later years in Cyprus, etc., except in case of self-defense. But they found themselves going beyond their mandate, and it was a bit of a watershed or a mark on the wall for the United Nations and the Congo at those days. They weren't quite sure how far they could go, and unfortunately, they were probably dragged into things they shouldn't have been dragged into.
They were, as soon as they arrived, they were stationed in Elizabethville, is that right?
Yes, Elizabethville and various duties around Elizabethville, the protection of the airstrip, the airport, and other installations in the area.
Because it was their first time out, they hadn't been on a previous mission out there. Were they in any way trained for the conditions? Were they briefed as to what
Yes.
to expect?
Yes, there had been Irish troops out there in the previous battalion, and so a lot of information would have come back. The troops were quite well trained. I suppose all officers would have made sure that their troops were well trained, and my father particularly would have been good at that. They had briefings on the Congo. In fact, in his big metal box that I have, there are briefing notes on the Congo, the population, the climate, what to wear, all that type of thing. They would have had a fair idea from a military point of view what they would have to do, but probably as regards the living conditions and so on, this would be totally new to them.
What the as soon as they found out that they had to go to Jadaville. Now this was, can you tell me the reason why again, just again?
Eddie Conn from Valentia Island.
Yeah.
Himself and my father played football for South Kerry on the same team. Okay, Eddie Condon, best man to my father and godfather to my sister, was adjutant. And when they came back out of prison from Jadaville, Dad asked Eddie, "Eddie, did you know when we were going to Jadaville that you were going to be putting in an attack on the 13th?" He said, "Yes. Why didn't you tell me? Because we know you'd go berserk after what happened here. You went berserk when they're going to be leaving
So
the
that's really
men."
what happened. Okay, you had two townships, and they were 80 miles between the two of them. And then you had roughly about north of Jadaville, you had the bush, which was There's a story there, and I want you to tell it to me.
Okay, well, just to kind of give the attitude and I suppose the feeling, as my father often described it to me about the whole business, was if we go back to August 61, a week or two before Jadaval, maybe 3 weeks before Jadaval, actually, he had to send a patrol way out 400 miles into the bush to rescue a government minister and his family to bring them back. They were apparently threatened. So he sent his second in command, Captain Byrne, and a Lieutenant Carey, Noel Carey, and 50 troops. They went out. They got the family, rescued them, brought them back, uneventful except for breakdowns of vehicles and things like that, and lack of radio connection between them and home base from time to time. And an interesting thing was about to happen in Elizabethville at that stage. In other words, the United Nations were going to overpower Chombe's garrison, Chombe's bodyguard, but Chombe actually must have got word of it or something, but he wasn't there that night, but his garrison was, and they were arrested. But that was supposed to happen on a certain night, I think, the 29th of August. Anyway, on the this was brought forward by 24 hours, this proposed action, and which didn't please my father too much because he had 50 troops way out in the bush, and they would have been left out on a limb. And they would have been, as it turned out, they were in a place called Kolwezi, which was, I don't know how many miles away, but it was further away than Jadaval, and you had this famous Lufira River to cross en route. And he felt that if they were left out there on their own, while an attack went in against Chombe's garrison in Elizabethville, that they would be annihilated. So he, of course, protested about this thing, but he was told that, no, we have to go ahead with what we're planning. And he was a little bit angry about this, to say the least. So he took his radio man, his signal corporal, you call him, Corporal Frank Williams, who apparently was brilliant, a wonderful guy. And they went up onto the high roof, flat roof of the airport in Elizabethville. And using map and compass, my father was able to determine the direction in which his patrol should have been. And Corporal Williams zeroed in his antenna, et cetera, and they picked them up. They were able to get communication, which was a bit of a miracle, really.
What did he say?
Using the vernacular, he said, "Tar harlash harnash lordok, agus be kurmukar an FCA around Balloch." And the poor old FCA, of course, here in Ireland, they were known as the enemy out there. And that was, so his second in command, Commandant Dermot Byrne, Captain Dermot Byrne, now retired General Dermot Byrne, living in Galway, he realized something was seriously wrong. And instead of bedding down for the night like they were going to do, they just got everybody on board again and headed off as fast as they could back and bluffed their way across the Lufira River and got back into Elizabethville in time for a few hours rest before they were involved in the attack on Chombe's headquarters.
No, that indeed was an experience that that led to the next situation, which was organizing his men, 150 troops in his command to go to Jadaval. Why were they going to Jadaval?
Yeah, well, here comes the big question. I mean, why did they have to go to Jadaval? They were asked by the Belgian SPAC. You'll have to check this yourself, whether it's the foreign minister or prime minister, I can't remember. SPAC asked for assistance in Jadaval from the United Nations to protect the white population who were feeling threatened by the black community. Now, the white population there were the workers and managers and so on of the copper mines, the Union Minière conglomerate. So what maybe people might not know is that there was already a company of Swedish troops with, I think, one Irish platoon already out there to do the same job, but they said, hey, this is wrong, these people don't want us, and the Swedes decided to pull out, and they pulled back and came back to Jadaval. Within a day or two, the Irish, i.e. my father's company, were told to go back out and do the same job. To the surprise of many people, including Major Mide of the Swedish company who had just left the place. Anyway, obeying orders, they went out to Jadaval. I think the 9th of September 61.
What were they confronted with?
Very, very quickly, it became very obvious to my father that they were not welcome there. They, far from being threatened by the black population, the whites actually control the black population because they control the jobs, and there were a lot of whites there, different nationalities. There, my father made contact with the head of Union Minière and got a very cool reception altogether. It became very obvious that the United Nations were not welcome in the town at all. He made contact with the mayor of the town, the same thing. He was more or less told, look, you're not welcome. Smelling a rat, he started digging in and protecting his base. And the interesting thing about the base, they were in a position that he, as a commander, probably would not have accepted if he ever thought he had to defend it. But it was what was rented by the United Nations, these villas and this area at the edge of the town. And he had no choice but to accept what he was given. But he realized there was something wrong, and that the position as given to him was not correct. So he sent back his doctor, who was with him, and one of his captains, Captain Liam Donnelly, back to Elizabethville so that they could tell the Irish commander and get the word to Conor Cruise O'Brien, who was the head of the United Nations in Elizabethville at the time, to get word to them about the true situation in Jadaville. They went back, they passed the information on, they were told the troops still had to stay in Jadaville. And I remember reading and hearing from Captain Donnelly and from my father that Captain Donnelly was told, you can stay here if you like, you know. And Captain Donnelly said, nope, my troops are back in Jadaville, I'm going back. And he went back and ended up in the fighting and ended up in prison for 6 weeks, etc., etc. So there was a very messy situation there. The other thing too, as a tactical person, my father saw the importance of the Lufira River and the Lufira Bridge, the famous bridge that later became very important. And he said that he wanted to control that bridge. So he wanted to send troops from Jadaville, approximately 15 miles to the bridge, to hold the bridge in case he ever had to retreat. And he was told by the headquarters in Elizabethville, no, don't do that. That would be provocative, etc., etc. Hindsight shows that if they had controlled the bridge, they would have had a way out, and the relief column coming up would have had a way in, and people would not have died.
So he got no support whatsoever coming from Elizabethville and the other Irish troops. Is that true?
Well, I don't know if I go as far as that. I think it was a question of politics and mixing up a little bit with military tactics and strategy. And as well as that, who knows what the information was like, whether intelligence was correct or not correct, whether the wool has been pulled over the eyes of the United Nations or not. But I myself feel now, having studied a little bit, they were like duped into going out there, probably to be held as more or less hostages to by the Katanganese in the event of something happening. And something did happen, of course, back in Elizabethville a few days later.
For 6 days, they were in the trenches.
Yes, I think it was the Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. 5 to 6 days.
Now, in that length of time, did your father ever know what kind of force that he was fighting against, or that he was trying to protect his troops from?
Well, he probably couldn't at that time put a full estimate to it, but other people have put estimates to that there were between 3,000 and 4,000, you know, at any given time against him. It turned out later that the bulk of the Katanganese troops were actually north of the, I think north is the correct direction, anyway, on his side of the Lufira River, not on the Elizabethville side. There was an attack put in, as you may know, on the 13th against the Katanganese military installations in Elizabethville, which unfortunately the people in Jadaville knew nothing about until it was too late. And they found that the number of troops were about equal in terms of 1,500, my memory is correct, 1,500 probably UN versus 1,500 Katanganese, whereas out in Jadaville, they're 140-something or 150-odd against a few thousand. A slight imbalance.
The chances of survival would have been very, very little, and yet your father decided that they were going to fight them off. And
really no choice. Really no choice. You know, they were attacked. They didn't attack anybody. They were at mass in the morning. I think it was about 7 o'clock mass every morning. About 25 past seven, I think my father was shaving or something when I left Noel Carey, got a message that there was an attack had been put in Elizabethville by the UN against the Katanganese. They were told it had gone in 3 hours before, and now they heard about it, and Lieutenant Carey went to warn everybody to be on their alert, because obviously everybody knew there'd be a reprisal immediately. And during mass, the reprisal came. The Katanganese started coming through in an attack. And I remember many, many years ago as a cadet hearing about this thing from one of the NCOs who was in Jadaville. And apparently the Katanganese came in Land Rover type vehicles with machine guns, and they were going to go in, shoot as many as they could, passing through, and there were other people waiting in the bush to come in then, attacking later. But they were stopped by fire from the Irish troops, and I think one of the first Land Rovers or vehicles was disabled, giving people time to run to their trenches, grab the rifles, run to the trenches and so on, and they were there ready to and able to repulse the first attack.
Were they under constant fire? Was this something that was going on a continuous basis?
Yes. They had a pretty tough time for a number of days, and they ran out of water, they were running low on ammunition and so on and so forth, and food was, at the minimal stage later on. The biggest problem as regards, from that point of view, as regards provisions and weapons and equipment was, when they were going out to Jadaville, they didn't have enough vehicles to carry all their heavy weapons. They couldn't bring the heavy mortars, they couldn't bring heavy machine guns, they couldn't bring a lot of things, they couldn't bring enough food. So they ended up thinking they were going to be resupplied. They ended up, in fact, near the end of the fighting with almost nothing to eat. Water had been cut off by the town, and water that was flown out to them by a helicopter turned out to be putrid. It had been put into jerry cans, I think, that had Vaseline in it or petrol in it anyway, so they couldn't drink the water, which was a bit of a demoralizing thing when they discovered that. But yes, they were under constant attack by artillery, by mortars, by Fuga jet bomber, which was a major problem. And, there's been a lot written about this thing, and I know that we got a blow-by-blow description of it in every letter that came from my father. And, in fact, a 17-page letter that came while he was in prison described every single incident of every single day.
Did your father talk to you about the keeping the morale of his men up, because that was a very important thing at the time to do?
Yeah, he mentioned it, but he said that he didn't really have to work too hard on that thing because they're all pretty good. The officers that were with him, he said they were incredibly good, and the NCOs were also fantastic, and he didn't have to work so hard on that. But then that's easy for him to say, but I know that being in the army myself, you keep the morale up by, I suppose, your example. And I think he gave good example. And, people speak well of him on a physical basis, going around in the trenches from time to time and talking to people and so on. So I'm sure he did what every officer or NCO will have to do when men under the command, by just example.
What was incredible was that none of these men were killed.
That's true. That's true. That is the big thing. And they appreciated it. I know that because later things happened around Christmas that showed this. But anyway, at that time, he had a good defensive plan. And I don't know if you know much about military stuff, but a perimeter defense is the most difficult defense to operation to carry out, because the enemy can come from any direction, and where do you have your reserve and where do you react to, and so on and so forth. But he had a classical defense, and he dug in everywhere. And I remember, as a young cadet, meeting a sergeant, Walter Hagerty, who is now a good friend. And when he heard my name, he said, "Are you anything to Pat Quinlan?" I said, "I am." He said, "That bloody man made us dig everywhere we went in the Congo." He said, we dug everywhere, but he said it saved us. So I thought it was interesting at the time.
No, there were a few. There were a few injuries, all right. But
five injuries. Five injuries, I think.
But it's extraordinary that with so much gunfire coming from the other side, they just survived it.
Yeah. Well, there are a number of reasons I think for that. One is that the defensive plan was good. They were well dug in, well protected. The other thing was that they tried to keep the enemy as far away as possible, not allow them to get into very close quarters. So they used their mortars and they used their machine guns to keep the enemy far out, hit them as far out as possible. And this was particularly successful, and the support platoon under Lieutenant Lee, Captain Liam Donnelly was tremendous at that.
Now, at any stage, was there an attempt made by the other Irish troops to send relief?
Yes, there were, and this was a big thing. Relief columns were sent. Again, please don't ask me to give you specifics because my dates and my numbers and so on, I'd have to refer to notes. But from my memory, there were a number of attempts made to get to Jadaville. But the big problem, again, was the Lufira River and the Lufira Bridge. There were two bridges. There was a road bridge and there was a railroad bridge. And the Katanganese demolished the railroad bridge, and that meant only the road bridge. So anybody coming up, Irish and Indian troops came and they tried to break their way through, and they couldn't make it because it was a narrow bottleneck. The bridge was very, very well reinforced, and unfortunately some people on the way, they lost their lives in this attempt, you know. And it's interesting that nobody in Jadaville died, and yet the people coming to help them, some of them did die. They carried out very brave actions. It was a brave attempt, but just didn't succeed, which is a pity. If the bridge had been allowed to be captured or held earlier on, before the trouble ever started, this would not have happened. You know, of course, that's...
If they had listened to your father's...
Well, advice, you know, I think he knew his business. Mm.
Did your father again mention at any stage that when he had to surrender, that it was a difficult thing to do?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. It was the most difficult thing he had to do in his life. But I think, you see, he just didn't take this Jadaville thing in isolation. He was aware of the bigger picture. He was aware that peace talks were negotiations, the whole United Nations mission out there, etc., etc., etc. He was quite a religious man, my father. Tough guy, but he was quite religious. And, you know, he said in his letters a few times, you know, about the Blessed Virgin was there on his shoulder from time to time. And he didn't feel comfortable about killing people. He didn't feel that they were there to be killing Africans, as he said. They were there to keep the peace, not to be doing this. So you had that plus other things, I suppose, bothered him a little bit. But I suppose the overriding thing was he wanted to bring all his men home alive. He knew that if he continued fighting, that they couldn't last much longer. They hadn't very much weaponry or ammunition left. They had certainly no water. It was stifling hot. They would have been suffering from malnutrition and dehydration very, very quickly. So he made a decision which was extremely difficult, and which some people didn't agree with. But I think the 140-something people he brought home alive did agree with, and certainly their families did. And certainly in hindsight, and history has proven that it was the right decision, but a difficult one to make.
What were the circumstances that directly after the surrender? What happened then?
Yeah, well, let me clarify one thing first. It wasn't a surrender, you know, and people who might listen to this, who are there, might like to have this emphasized. It was a ceasefire. Big difference. There was an agreed written ceasefire between him and his counterpart on the opposite side, and of which I have a copy of it, written in English and French. A ceasefire which said that the Irish could keep their weapons, that they would have joint patrols between them and the Katanganese, and that they would just generally keep the peace and see where things would go. But as soon as the ceasefire was called officially, it became a surrender in the eyes of the others, the enemy. So you can say that the
company... Was there trickery involved
yes,
then?
Obviously. The Katanganese did not live up to the terms of the written ceasefire. And I mean, this document exists today. I have the original. Yeah.
Now they were brought to a prison camp.
Yes.
Where exactly
Jadaville.
Was that? In Jadaville.
In Jadaville. Yes, they were imprisoned first in Jadaville in the hotel. I think it's called Hotel Europe in Jadaville. They were reasonably well treated. In fact, a lot of the enemy came up and congratulated them on their defense and how good they were as soldiers, etc. They were treated with respect. I think they used to call my father the Irish Major or something like that in French. They were fairly well treated, and then guards changed, and now I don't know all the circumstances, but then they began to be less well treated. Particularly, the enemy were probably a little bit upset when they found there were no dead Irish, and they had people say something like 300 of their own casualties, and they were digging up where the Irish defensive positions were, looking for dead Irish bodies, couldn't find anybody, and this didn't make them too happy either. One thing you have to remember, in Jadaville at the time, there were other people as well, women. Yes, as regards reinforcements and radio communications, etc., yes, many occasions, as I've read in the notes and so on, my father's notes, he did ask for reinforcements to come, both in English language and in Irish language. And they said, yes, we'll try. But eventually reinforcements were sent, but probably they were sent too late, probably... maybe they could have done better, maybe not, but it's very difficult now to say, not being on the spot there. It's just a pity they weren't able to get across the Lufira Bridge. And in fairness to them, some of them were killed. But what was the major problem, I think, tactical problem at the higher level, was that they pulled back from the bridge. Not having failed to get through, they said, we're returning to Elizabethville. So, but the very fact of them returning the 80 miles back to Elizabethville left the Irish out there in Jadaville with absolutely no moral support or physical support, and they were seen to be totally vulnerable in the eyes of the enemy. Look, even your own people have gone back. So when it came to ceasefire negotiations and everything, they were at a distinct disadvantage. And I know that from radio messages that my father asked, don't pull back, stay near the bridge. Because just purely from a bargaining position, having a relief column on the bridge while you're negotiating in Jadaville would have been stronger than if they're already gone back to Elizabethville and they're left on their own in Jadaville. Yeah. This was a serious situation.
Okay. How long were they in the camp before they were offered as hostages?
I think they spent 6 weeks in prison altogether, prison camp, and they were between two camps. They were in Jadaville and Kolwezi. They moved to Kolwezi for a particular reason. There was a supposed exchange of prisoners to take place in Elizabethville on a certain date. Let's just assume it was early October. I don't know the exact date. They traveled to Elizabethville. Something happened politically, diplomatically. The exchange of prisoners didn't take place. And they were brought back, but bypassed Jadaville and brought out into Kolwezi. I remember my father telling me a story about on the route back, they stopped at some village. And they thought they were going to be all killed because they were herded out of the buses they were in. All the women in the villages were chanting and waving knives. We will have meat tonight, this type of thing, as it was described to me. And they thought they were in serious difficulties. And what happened was a Belgian officer, who my father doesn't know who, his name, he used his forceful personality and a few kicks and whatever against the black guards and forced them to desist whatever they were thinking of doing and allowed the Irish to get back onto the buses. You know, it was a very tense situation, but this Belgian, my father often said, probably saved us from massacre. And one story about that is a man who later became my commanding officer, now dead Lord Mercenham, Colonel Joe Leach, then a lieutenant, later commandant when I was a captain. The story told about him being, he always had a kind of a little swagger cane under his arm. He was a very brave man. And he was being herded to the bus, and the black guards were jabbing him in the back. I think they had either short bayonets or something, but anyway, they're jabbing him in the back, and he just turned around with a swagger cane, slashed at their weapons, and the force of his personality, they all jumped back and went away from him. They could have easily done him serious damage, but that was the kind of man he was. You know, it's just a little anecdote.
Yes. It must have really knocked their, their morale must have been knocked.
Big time.
Every time.
Yes. Big time this time. They thought they were going to be released and they were brought back out. And then they devised a plan that the next time they were going to be released, because they now knew the route back. They now knew the route. And they knew that the route would pass a railway station of some kind. And they said, if we go back the next time and are not released, on the way back, we will overpower the guards. We will go hijack a train. They had a train driver. One of the guys was able to drive a train. We'll grab a train, and wherever the train goes, whatever direction it's going in, we'll go there. And they practiced overpowering guards and so on and so forth. And they had little secret meetings while they're in Kolwezi, this was, if my memory is correct. But anyway, the second time they came back, they were released.
Mm-hmm. Now, after that ordeal, mm-hmm. they were back again in Elizabethville, and they were meeting their companions, yes, and the other
yes,
troops.
Yes.
How did that meeting go when they came back?
I don't know too much about this. Obviously, many of them were very happy to see them. They were all happy to see them, I imagine.
But was there any bad word spoken? You know, why didn't you come and help us, lads? You know, you know, we were out there on our own, you know.
I don't know. My father has never said anything much about this to me. I've heard stories from other people, you know, but let's say he never told me. I've heard stories as one or two incidents happened where my father might have got a bit angry with somebody, but, you know, I can't quote it because I didn't hear it from him. You know?
Right. As soon as they got their release and they were back again, they found themselves back in action.
Exactly, exactly. Back in action, doing different things, making raids, checkpoints, all this type of thing. And then they have the famous Battle of the Tunnel, I think it was December of 61, prior to them coming back. You know, some of them had already gone home, and the ones that were left back out were still involved. And in one of these incidents, I think it was Private Jimmy Redman got injured in one of these incidents, and he came back on a stretcher. And I knew him well later in years in the army. He got, somebody said, about 5 pieces of shrapnel in his back, something like that. But yes, they were involved. And they had the job then of easing the 36th Battalion, which is normal takeover. You know, if you're out there, the new people come, you show them the ropes and so on. And incidents like one young man who was later killed, he was about to fire an anti-tank gun, forgetting that he had some men just behind him that would have been damaged badly in the back blast of the anti-tank gun. And they were new recruits to, not recruits, they were new to the place. So you had that element of it as well, which was an interesting element. And all the time they were just waiting, when can we go home, when can we go home? And it was delayed, etc., from time to time. And my father eventually arrived home a week later than most people, because the last man out kind of thing. And you know, I think it was just a few days before Christmas, 22nd of December, when he arrived.
How was he greeted when he got back?
Very well. We lived in Athlone at the time, and he was supposed to arrive on a certain day at Athlone station, coming down from Dublin by train, and he didn't because of some delay, and half the town were there. So then the next day he came, and half the town were still there again, you know, waiting. He got a good reception, and all the men with him got a great reception, I must say. It was gratifying.
But that was Athlone. What about Dublin and the government?
I think it was very, very low key. Basically, for years, nothing much was ever said about it, of course. It's all been kind of possibly forgotten about, or the whole incident. And it's only now that things are coming out about Jadeville, you know, that's where it's out in the open and where people can talk about it. And there's no shame attached to it. In fact, it was a brilliant piece of work if you look at it from a military point of view.
Why do you think that this story has been forgotten about?
Well, it was, I suppose, deliberately forgotten about, because things happened out there, not the Jadeville situation, just the United Nations situation in general. I mean, if you read the reports about what happened there, Cruz O'Brien never told his bosses what he was doing. The military people didn't tell their bosses what was happening in Elizabethville. Dag Hammarskjöld was flying out to the Congo to to check on the situation, and he landed somewhere else overnight. And then he was told about the attack that went in on the 13th in Elizabethville, 13th of September. He didn't sanction it. He never knew about it. United Nations sent their own people out to check the situation later, and reports are written about it, which just, you know, hit hard at the fact that the people in power who should have made the decision were not informed. So it was quite embarrassing for the United Nations, and to have anything else embarrassing about being left out in Jadaville as pawns in a bigger chess game, etc., it was more or less, don't talk about this, don't talk about this. You know, so you had that element. There was a lot of self-protection later on, I imagine. United Nations didn't cover themselves in glory in the Congo, generally speaking, and Jadaville was just one part of it, and so I think that's the reason.
The men,
yes,
a lot of them just couldn't take the pressure of what happened.
Yeah, you see, this was you have to think of the age group of these guys out there. Some of them were only 15 years of age. Two or three of them, I think, were about 15. A lot of 16, 17, 18-year-olds. They're very, very young. And then you had up my father, 42, and two of his NCOs were older than him, maybe 43, 44 at the time. And, you know, but none of them had ever been in action. Not one had ever been in any kind of action before that. And all of a sudden thrown into this type of action, which was very intense. And nobody wavered. They all did a fantastic job. But this was in the age before people started thinking about post-traumatic stress syndrome, et cetera, which the Irish Army now takes very seriously. And you have special units in the army or special teams in the army who go to all the places where you have Irish troops at the moment and checking things. Are you okay? Blah, blah, blah. Do you want to talk? And checking that there's no stress. But in those days, no. So I know of some of the soldiers later committed suicide, a shocking situation. One can assume that the Jadaville experience and other experiences in the Congo may have contributed to it. I don't know. I don't know the individual cases, of course. But then again, there are other fellows that are in Jadaville, and I meet them, and I've served with them, and I was on ranger courses with them, and they were brilliant. You know, I'm not going to say it made men of them, but it certainly built them in some way, some effect.
But a lot of these soldiers who were in your father's company were actually slagged when they came home about the famous surrender, as you said.
Yeah, I've heard this. But remember, I was 16. I joined the army a year later, and I spent 25 years in the army. Nobody ever said to me anything derogatory about Jadaville. Nobody. And I mean, I think that's significant that they didn't. Whether they ever disagreed with the surrender, so-called surrender, ceasefire, I like to think of it, or not, I don't know. But nobody ever made me feel any way bad about it. So I've heard that there were incidents among other ranks where, you know, and that could be after a few drinks, somebody, blah, 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 and a few fists would be thrown. I'm not sure. I've heard it, but I've no experience of it.
How was your father treated in Athlone the days that followed his return with his troops?
Well, this was, a very nice time for everybody. He was back, he was safe, and all his men were safe. And there was a nice feeling of well-being everywhere. And I can remember Christmas Day in our house. From the time we came back from Mass on Christmas, our doorbell never stopped ringing in the house in Beach Park in Athlone. And every time, I answered it a lot of the time, and there you'd have young children or maybe teenage kids or a wife or something, families of soldiers that had come back from Jadaville, and all of them giving gifts for my father, things like a bottle of whiskey or a Christmas cake or a box of chocolates, rosary beads, missiles, prayer books. And this was the time, of course, when everybody was sitting down, kneeling down at nighttime saying the family rosary. But it was just, I have a great memory of that all the time.
Your mother at home, now she must have been worried, you know. Was there information coming home to her about what was happening?
The information was coming sporadically, and a lot of it was incorrect. You know, we have to remember it was 46 something years ago, 47 years ago. And in the communication between the Congo and Ireland was bad at the best of times, I suppose. And the Department of Foreign Affairs were getting mixed messages, and United Nations New York were getting mixed messages, and we weren't helped by British press and so on. So nobody knew what to believe. I mean, we had a situation where we're getting phone calls on an hourly basis from the army headquarters telling my mother what was happening. But usually it was, we don't know, we don't know. Mm-hmm. And then we had a situation on the Friday of that week when the Evening Herald, wherever they got the information from, stated that all of the company in, were massacred, and that officers had been executed by firing squad, etc. So that was a real Black Friday. In fact, it was a blackout, electricity blackout, a big storm that Friday, and it was really a Black Friday. I remember walking through Athlone that day, and it was terrible. And then all the wives of the officers of my father gathered around my mother that weekend, and they stayed in Athlone, and they were in my house, our house at the time. And they were actually talking about how they would have a funeral service without bodies. And, you know,
they expected the worst.
They did. They assumed the papers were correct and that everybody was dead. And we were waiting and waiting for official word. And we were actually talking about what kind of funeral services we would have collectively or individually. I remember that time. I was 16. And then on the Sunday morning, we got a word phone call that they're all safe. They're all alive, nobody dead. And I was in that habit of every time we get a phone call, I'd be driving down to Assumption Road, as a kind of residential area in Athlone, where a lot of my father's NCOs and men lived. And I'd be cycling down on the bicycle to give them the latest, because nobody had phones in those days. And they'd be all waiting, watching at the windows. Every time my bicycle appeared at the beginning of the road, they'd all run out onto the footpath. So I remember the morning that we got the message that they're safe. I jumped on my bike, fast as I could, to cycle down there. They all ran out onto the road, and at the same time a staff car from the barracks came and pulled up among the crowd of maybe 30-50 people who were gathering. And this was Commandant Owen Curtin. He was command duty officer at the time, and he got out of the car, and I'll never forget it, there were tears running down his cheeks. And they thought the worst when they saw the tears. So I just waited, because I was only a kid, and I waited for him to tell it. And then he said, when he caught his breath, he said, "They're all alive." Well, there were hysterics and smiles and singing and laughing and crying and everything, you know. So that was a memorable time for me, you know. In those days, it was something.
Your father has been commended, mm-hmm. And that happened only recently, in 2005, I think. It's good that he's now recognized as one who fought a great battle and saved his men.
Yeah, well, I mean, if my father was here, he'd be probably the person to say that it's not just him, they all fought the battle, because they were incredible men. To listen to him talk about them, they were number one in his eyes, always were. And sure, they've been all vindicated, and his decision has been vindicated, and so on. It took a long time, and it's the efforts of various people over the years have done it, Captain Liam Donnelly in particular, and the route he took to get this brought to the people's attention, the Army's attention, and John Gorman from near Mount Temple in County Westmeath, the same thing. He went at a different route. And the various books that have been written about it, and I suppose times have changed. And now they've got something, the Irish Army have got something good in terms of a case history of a tactical situation where hopefully it will save people's lives in the future and will stop some stupid decisions we made like this again in the future.
In August, your father had a situation. The situation came from one of the leaders in Elizabethville, when he told him that 50 of his troops would have to go on a mission. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, well, it's not exactly, he just told him that 50 men had to go on a mission. The company were given the mission of going out to rescue, in inverted commas, a Congolese minister, i.e. minister of government, who was somewhere out 400 miles out into the bush and felt threatened by the local population. So a company were given the task, and having done whatever planning they was done, my father dispatched his second in command with the strengthened platoon. A platoon is roughly 35 people, and he sent out 50, a few armored cars and signal people and so on. So they went out, they did the job. It was a 10-day thing, if I remember reading correctly, 10 days. Not an easy one with the terrain, the broken axles of vehicles and so on. They had to abandon an armored car, which, you know, a couple of £100,000 worth of an armored car, etc. And they were making their way back, and they were at a place called Kolwezi when an attack or an operation is probably a better word for it, was being organized in Elizabethville to take over Chombe's headquarters and to arrest his mercenary bodyguard and so on, who were arrested and were deported out of the Congo and came back later with much strengthened. But this operation, which was supposed to happen on a certain day, was brought forward 24 hours. Of course, this didn't please my father at all, because he realized that his troops were, 50 of his troops were then going to be left out on a wing, unsupported in enemy territory beyond the Lufira River. And he went, as somebody would say, berserk about this thing. And he went to his boss and said, this is not right. And the boss said, they'll be okay. Whatever was said anyway, the attack was brought forward 24 hours, meaning that my father considered his 50 soldiers to be very much at risk.
But your father must have known the danger at that stage. You know, 50 of his men were gone and
yes, of course. I mean, I suppose everybody knew the danger, but he just wanted to get his men back, and he wanted to get them back before this attack went in on Chombe's headquarters. And although he fought for the attack not to be brought forward, but he wasn't successful, so he had to find some way to bring his troops back. And consequently, as I said earlier to you, he went up onto the roof of the building, the high building at the airport, with his signalman, Corporal Williams, and they were able to raise them using map compass and radio. They were able to raise them and told them to come back as fast as they could, and they did. They got back, and only a few hours to spare before the attack went in.
And in Chombe's headquarters, now that it was important, really, wasn't it, to make sure that that rescue would take place?
Yes. Well, from my understanding, a political decision was made that Chombe had to be somehow or other neutralized, or his power taken away from him, and the idea was that he would be arrested. And that meant they'd have to overpower the garrison that protected him. And that was done, but Chombe wasn't there. He wasn't in his residence on that particular night. Whether he knew something was happening or not, I don't know. There is a suggestion that the place was infiltrated with a lot of informers, because the United Nations troops out there were using a lot of local laborers, houseboys and drivers and cleaners, etc., who they think might have been passing messages back about what was happening. Anyway, Chombe's headquarters was taken by surprise. The guard were overpowered. Nobody was killed. It was a good tactical operation, which incidentally was led by a company, my father's company, and supported by others. And it was at that time then, of course, that the guys had managed to come back from their 400-mile patrol, and they were back safely. But this was the first military action where the UN went against the Katanganese, and then the next one was on the 13th of September when they went against them again. Only that time, when they went against them, they were expected. It wasn't as much of a surprise as they were hoping it would be. And I think because of the one against Chombe, tipped the people, the Katanganese, off to be either more alert or at least to find out a bit more. But either way, they were not terribly surprised by the UN action on the 13th.
Everybody knew about it except the people in Jadaville.
Everybody knew about the action in the 13th in Elizabethville, but the people in Jadaville who should have known about it didn't know anything about it. That this was going on, and it was planned for weeks before they were sent to Jadaville, and one of the company commanders was not informed about the planning of an attack by his own battalion.
Where was the coordination then?
Well, it was well coordinated at Elizabethville, and I suppose that it comes down to my father's personality to some extent too. If he thought that an attack was going to be put in on the 13th in Elizabethville, he would have created havoc about being sent out on a limb, unsupported, across the Lufira River, a bit like his patrol of a few weeks earlier that was sent out without ongoing support. You know, it would have been tactically a stupid thing to do, yeah, to go out on a place like that. You know, so he didn't know about it. And if he had known about it, he'd have probably gone a little bit berserk.
Yes. And who was your father's mother's people then?
Here? They were O'Shea's. My mother, my grandmother, Mary O'Shea, lived in Renin, just maybe 600 yards from where my father's house was. And she was a lovely lady. She lived to be 90 years of age. And she worked for 11 years in, I think, New York or Philadelphia, and for 11 years way back in the 1880-somethings or 1890s. And then came back here to marry my grandfather. So that's a little bit about the background,
yeah,
of the family.
Yeah. Yourself, you joined the army at a very young age too.
Yeah, I joined the army at 17. I was a cadet, 2 years in the military college. And then after that, I was based in Dublin immediately and on the border in a number of places, in the Western Command in Athlone, up in Donegal, in Limerick, and eventually down in Tralee, County Kerry, where I finished my army career, having completed 25 years. For various reasons, I decided I would leave. And that's my army career, basically.
Yeah. And would you have joined the army now because of your father's achievements in the army, maybe? Or did it rub off you?
Well, I suppose it had to rub off. Not necessarily his achievements. Of course, I'm very proud of him, everything he ever did. He's my hero, always was, always will be. But I suppose I grew up in an army environment. You know, I met a lot of army friends of my father's, I should say. I grew up with children of army officers and all that type of thing. So I knew the army environment. I was in the FCA, having told a lie about my age, I was in the FCA, just barely 15 years of age. So I just love the army.
Yeah. Well, Leo Quinlan, thank you very much for telling me your story. Thank you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.